Welcome, listeners, to a brand new bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast. And today we have such a special treat because we have author Mr. Thomas Taylor with us today. We already spoke about one of his books, Malamander, about a few episodes back, which you'll see the link for that in the episode notes. So listen to the interview, then go listen to our review on the book, and then go buy the book for yourself and for your friends. Yeah, I think that should cover everything. Okay, well, Mr. Thomas Taylor, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Esther. Thank you for inviting me.
I am so excited that you're here, which I think I've already said at least 14 times. So this will be 15 times. And I'm looking forward. As we always start, we'll just dive right in. How did you get into this? Why did you decide, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a children's book. How did that even start?
Well, I've always worked in children's books because I started out as an illustrator. So I went to art school and have a whole kind of career in picture books, actually. So for about 10 or 12 years, I just did picture books mostly and started off illustrating them, then began to write them, and then began to really kind of love writing picture books. It's a whole kind of art to that. But also I became more and more drawn to the idea of really exploring language and writing something a bit longer and a bit more substantial. And it took me a long time to pluck up the courage to start. But so in fact, I kind of have always had, not quite always, but I left art school and went straight into work in a specialist children's bookshop in the UK. And got an agent a couple of years after that as an illustrator. So I had, and she was also a literary agent. She took me on as an illustrator. And then after about 10 years, I had to go to her and see whether she'd be okay with me transitioning, because it's not a given that, you know, she would be happy with that. And it were a few awkward conversations to start with as I tried to convince her to allow me to. So really, it's not, I don't have a traditional routine where I've done something else and then sort of pushed and got in. I've kind of always worked in children's books one way or another. And Malamander is kind of my breakout fiction, middle grade fiction book, really. It's where I've kind of finally landed on my feet, really, with writing that more substantial fiction. I think it's substantial. I know it's middle grade, but for me, it's quite a big deal.
Yeah, I've asked the question often of authors, when you say that you write middle grade or even picture books or anything like that, if people are like, oh, well, then you're not a real author. Like, it's not until you write adult that they're like, oh, now you're an author. But it's hard writing for younger audiences. You have much less words to speak with, and you have to get it to the point. It's not an easy thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you're writing middle grade fiction, I wanted to write more substantially. I wanted to have a big word count. But you still have to pare it right down. You still have to think about every word and justify everything. And Malamander really was pared right down. I really had to work to bring it down to, it's 55,000 words. And by nature, I would probably have written 80,000. So you can imagine the effort I had to put in to bring it down to 50,000, 55,000. But yeah, I get the same. Oh, you're a writer, how exciting. Oh, well, you're a children's book writer. Oh, well, okay. You know, and you can sort of see in their eyes what they're thinking. I just shrug it off.
Yeah, it's funny. 80,000, you almost could have been a young adult author with that word count. Was it not difficult to try to go from picture books, you have a few hundred words, going to middle grade, which is a few thousand? I came into writing through screenwriting, which a lot of authors kind of follow in path. And screenwriting worked very well for me because it was very specific and very pared down. So when I wrote my first novel, I'm like, where am I supposed to find so many words from? But it sounds like you went opposite, because you went over and then you had to cut down.
Yeah, I think the thing is, when I first started writing something that wasn't a picture book, I set out to just see whether I could. So I just picked the theme pirates and began writing a pirate adventure, thinking it would be for kind of 5 to 8 year old, full of drawings. It just ballooned into this epic, I think it was nearly 100,000 words by the time I told my agent I was working on it. And she would say, well, you've been quite quiet. You want to tell me anything? And I said, well, can we have a conversation? Because I'm writing this book. But I had no real sort of understanding of the market, really. I kind of did, because I worked in a bookshop, so I'd seen what was selling. But I mean, I was writing this book, and I sent it to her. She said, I need to read this thing you're writing. And it was quite a nerve-wracking moment, because I might have been rejected by my own agent, you know. And she got back to me and said, well, she said, I mean, blowing my own trumpet, she said, you have all the gifts, and I'm very happy to represent you as a writer. So that was an enormous relief. But then she said, but this book's unpublishable. You'll never get this published. It's just this epic thing. And anyway, pirates are completely out of favour. Nobody wants pirates now, because they tried pirates 2 years ago and it was a flop. So, you know, it was great. But at the same time, it was very encouraging, though. And she showed it to a couple of editors, quite sort of senior editors at publishers, who for a favour to her, had a look at it and wrote a sort of editorial report, both being very encouraging and saying, we'd love to see more from you, but this is unpublishable. So anyway, but it was just to prove the point, really. So, but it was a lot of effort for that. But it didn't really feel like a complete rejection because I was already kind of there. Do you see what I mean? I wasn't coming from cold looking for an agent. I managed to convince one I already had. So yeah, so that's kind of how that started. But that book is unpublished. And so I went away to write something else. And basically, I took this encouragement and went away. And unfortunately, I kind of went down the wrong road because I did actually decide maybe I should be writing longer fiction. I should maybe write YA. So I did actually, my next project was a YA science fiction kind of adventure, which was longer, which I did eventually get published. But it was quite a hard slog, and it turned out ultimately not. I mean, I'm not really. My head is not YA at all. I don't really get YA. You know, I don't really. I'm not very good at writing about kids who are cool. I'm not really very good at the kind of teen romance side of it. And you kind of, you know, I was just on the wrong track. And I could see over time, I could see on the right track beside me where I should be. So it took me some time to get over there. But I did get that book published, so can't have been that bad. But I mean, I'm quite proud of that book. It's called Haunters, and it was out. It came out in the US, and it was a sort of ghost story turned on its head. Big time travel element, but it nearly blew my head apart because the time travel side of it was just so crazy. The experience of writing that and then writing another book and not getting that published and thinking I'm just writing the wrong thing is what really put me back on track thinking about what I should be doing. And I realized everything I'd written to that point that was, you know, liked and successful, the people that responded to was all in a kind of middle grade mode, and everything that I'd struggled with was in YA. And so ultimately that's what led me to try again, but aim full square at that middle grade audience, you know, the 9 to 12, 8 to 12 core audience, and think a lot about what it is that they want. You know, what do they want? You know, I really spent a lot of time thinking about what would make a perfect middle grade novel. And while we won't pretend that Malamander is perfect, I think it can't have hurt to have been thinking that much about the tone and what you'd need, how it would be, and try to bring all that into it.
Do you have, I don't really know how to say this, but I guess like an articulation of what you've decided that this is what they want? Like they want a fun tone or anything like that you said, okay, if I keep these things in mind, I'll probably get the middle grade down correctly. Do you have anything like that you can share?
It's hard to say really, but I just, in terms of, for example, up until Malamander, I'd never really concentrated on a sense of place. So I've never written a place and tried to bring that into the character. So I tried to write characters that the reader would want to spend time with, but I'd never created a place that the reader would want to be while the reader spent time with the characters. So I really put a lot of effort into Erie-on-Sea, into this town. I really kind of drew that out of myself to try and make the place a character in the story, which I've heard people do, and I just thought, why haven't I done this before? And there's things like that, and also that sense that kids love to be scared, but only up to a point. And you have to find that balance where you can go really easily go over it and you've terrified them. But if you drop down too low, then they're not quite, they just want that perfect moment, and trying to balance that perfect, I mean, it's really hard to get right with humour as well. So you've got this kind of almost horror, you know, going on. And then you've also got humour balancing it and trying to find that balancing point. I mean, I put a huge effort into trying to get that right. Because I do think that's what kids, they just love to be a bit scared, but not too much.
Yeah, it's almost like getting that right. There's almost no formula for it. It's almost like you either nail it or you don't. Because sometimes you can try too hard to be funny so it doesn't pass over. Or sometimes also that scare. There is scary stuff going on, but maybe, I don't know, maybe if you don't sit on it too much. Like if it would be YA and you have someone shooting harpoons at kids, someone would have to get hit, someone would have to die, and then it would be like, I don't want to go on. Like you'd have to go through all that in YA. Then middle grade, you duck, and then you're done. Like you have to scream, what are you going to utter? I guess. I don't know. That's a little simplistic, because it's almost like the way it happens almost. I don't know. Just I was thinking about that. It's sort of like...
It's a slightly cartoonish element to the violence. You just have to keep that slight sort of sense. It's just a bit Scooby-Doo. You know, it's... The harpoon is real, you know, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Just, you know...
Yes, that's exactly it. So that's actually interesting, because Malamander does have illustration in it, but you didn't illustrate that. Unless you have a pen name for your illustration, but... You never thought, or was it even an option for you to be a writer-illustrator for this? Or it was totally not even, or like, what was that? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I get asked about this quite a lot, because, in the UK edition, I have done drawings inside, but they're only very, very small, kind of decorative chapter heading pictures. So each chapter has this little sketch that's just supposed to evoke the feeling of, but what I didn't want to do is draw any of the characters. I didn't want to draw the Malamander because I wanted the reader to be able to sort of see all that for themselves. So I was drawing in the words, but I didn't actually sketch out how they looked. But the US publisher said for this age, this market, it would be great to have a sort of really lavishly illustrated book. I didn't want to do that much illustration. But they had someone in mind already, and they had Tom Booth in mind. And when I saw Tom Booth's drawings, I just thought, well, they fit really well with my style, because it's sort of there's mystery and magic, but there's also humour and it's a bit sort of funny at times. And you know, he drew Herbie really well, he draws Violet really well, and I just thought, this is going to work really well. But I'm quite grateful that I'm not having to do this, because it's quite hard work. I mean, I can see what he's done is very hard work. So yeah, there is a difference. The UK and the US editions are quite different in that respect. And I get asked about the cover a lot. So the cover is done. The covers have changed a bit, but they get done by somebody else in the UK as well. So.
Yeah, I've seen before how they'll switch covers out according to countries and things like that, but I didn't realize that they would go so far to include illustration in one edition and not. So the UK only gets little sketches, and us here in America, we get full on illustration. That's amazing for us.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's just it goes to show how different the market is, because actually in the UK, it would be quite unusual to fully illustrate a book like that. Whereas clearly in America, it's expected for that age. Well, it's not expected all the time, but again, I wouldn't have thought to do that, but I mean, I'm so happy with the result, I can't complain. And in some countries that have taken on the other text, they've used the UK cover and the US illustrations inside. So, I mean, they kind of pick and choose.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Well, I don't necessarily know the answer to that, but I wonder if that's connected, or I don't even know if you know the answer to this, but graphic novels are becoming really big out here. Are they also pushing graphic novels for middle grade and young adult in England, or not necessarily?
Graphic novels have always been a bit of a hard sell in the UK, and there's always been a slight sort of problem with their perception and their reception, and that's a real shame. I think there's a sort of inbuilt cultural snobbery, to be honest, that it's not real reading if there are lots of pictures, and I think that's part of British culture, I'm afraid. And I mean, I've done a graphic novel myself as the illustrator. So I mean, that was published in the US. It wasn't published in the UK. It's just a different sort of culture, and it's a shame. But they are popular. I mean, kids do love them, and they like them here. But the range here is quite limited. You go to America, and you've got sort of stacks and stacks. Yeah. Same in France. Same in Italy. You go into a bookshop in France, there's a whole section on bande dessinée, on graphic design, on graphic novels, and you can be there all day. You know, it's amazing. It comes to the UK, and it's going to be one shelf in the corner of the shop.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because here they're pushing it as a gateway for kids to read, and even if they only get to stay with the graphic novel, everyone's happy because they're still picking up a book, and even if it's, because art's its own story. So that's so interesting how, I think I once read an article by an author, I don't remember who it was, but she was talking about how in the UK, books in general are given like a, I don't want to say a higher status, but people have a greater regard for reading in general. But the catch is that in America, you just have a bigger market. So even if people say, oh, a writer, but at the same time, even if you're only selling like, a writer level of sales, you're still selling more than the UK, just gets a bigger population. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, in the end, every country is different. And it's interesting how you spot these differences through the process of having a book translated as well. And that country that absolutely refuses to have anything to do with any of the art that's been created so far at all, and does it all from scratch for themselves. Like the Danish edition, for example, is just completely different cover, everything. They just couldn't go on board with anything that had been done already. They've done their own thing. But it's interesting because that was never anticipated.
How does that work that they get a book, especially because you mentioned that you have a book that's only been published in the US and not the UK? When your agent is sending out, being in the UK, does that mean she has to know both markets that well to be able to figure out who she's pitching to? Or you start off in the UK and they're like, oh, send it over to our sisters overseas? Or like, how does that work?
Well, with Malamander, Walker Books, who published Malamander in the UK, they are a sister publisher with Candlewick Press. So it was part of the deal that a Candlewick Press have now got an imprint called Walker US. So there's a kind of connection there already. So it was sort of built in from early on that there would be a US edition. But with the graphic novel, that was the author really sold that direct to the US. He had connections. This is Marcus Sedgwick. I don't know if you're aware of Marcus Sedgwick. He's the author. But quite often, if books published in one country, and then at some point, the publisher's sales reps or international team will start trying to find overseas co-editions. And of course, for an English language book, the US edition, if you can get one, is a really big, it's a big deal. And then after that, there's other countries as well to pursue.
Did you have to change anything because it didn't, or is that the translator's job because it doesn't translate well into another language? Where they're like, oh, we don't talk like this here.
Yeah, I mean, with the US edition, just there is a sort of moment in the editorial process where all the pavements are turned into sidewalks and all the things and that kind of thing. There's a bit of that. But then with other countries, there are moments where, like, for example, in my novel Gargantis, which is the sequel, don't spoil it, but there's a creature called Gargantis. It turns out to be female. And in some languages, they've taken Gargantis as the title and the name, but that doesn't work grammatically with how they construct females. So, I mean, I've never even thought about that, but that's caused some people a headache. And there are lots of little things where I've created a secret code in Gargantis, and that has caused the translators quite a bit of trouble because the way it works. So there are all these things emerge, and I'm quite free and easy, and I happily talk to the translators. They can all get in touch with me, and we have quite long conversations sometimes as I sort of try and meet them halfway and help them out a bit.
That's so funny.
Suggest things.
Because they can't make any changes without checking with you first, I guess, so you have to figure out like what changes you'd approve of.
Well, I don't get final approval of their translation because I can't read the finished translation. You know, I don't know what they can do what they like in the end. But I up to a point, if there's a substantial change, I mean, I trust them, and they it's an art translating these books. It's making it work in other languages. It's just amazing that they can do it. So but so far it's worked okay. So that's the fun part of it.
I got to tell you, there's one thing, this is not even related to anything, but the one thing I'm a little worried about is so Shadow Gasp, right, which is the third one, just coming out at the end of this year, or October, November?
September.
September. But when I saw the pre-order, it was in hardcover, and I have Malamander and Gargantis in paperback, and that's going to ruin my set. So I'm struggling now to figure out, do I buy the hardcover, or do I have to wait a full year until the paperback comes out? This is what I worry about at night.
I know what you mean. Yeah. Well, the news was announced today, and I'm going to take this. The news was finally announced today that there are two further books. So there will be five books in total. It's a five-book series now.
I'm so excited. Wait, okay. Was it originally planned as a standalone, and then you got the other two, and now you got another two, or you thought it was going to be a series, and now you got the other two?
It was originally, first of all, I was just trying to create this one book, but I knew I had more material than... I knew there was too much material there to just stop and say it's a standalone. I had this whole sort of world I created, and there was things to do and things to find out. But it went to auction, so it was actually acquired after an auction. And during that auction process, publishers that were vying for it added on other books. It was never intended to be a trilogy. It was just sort of, by the time the auction ended, there were three books on the table. It was a three-book deal. But I never had the idea that it was just... trilogy. So I ended up sitting down sometime later and thinking, you know, how many books could this be realistically? You know, is it seven? Is it nine? And I thought seven and nine was just really pushing my luck, and there was just the real risk of running thin at the end. But five seemed like a good number. So quite early on, I suggested to the publisher that I might be looking at five books here. Are you looking at five books here? They kind of all went pale because they hadn't even put the first one out yet. But it's kind of worked out. So they have agreed, and they've added two more on. In fact, I've finished the first draft of the fourth one, and I'm about to start editing that. So I'm quite far into the whole thing.
Wow.
And the fifth one will be the really hard one to write, because that's the one where I'll finally reveal things about Herbie and Violet's parents, and the Malamander will return, and there's sort of lots of things that will kind of tie up what's happened previously. Because there is a story arc that moves over the five books, even though each book is a separate story.
That is so exciting. I'm so excited. So does that, having that sense of place that the place is kind of, it's all, like Erin on the Sea is sort of its own kind of character, does that help with being able to write more books in a series?
Yeah, it's like I've set the stage now. But at the same time, I noticed writing the fourth one that it was starting to feel a bit samey. They were just going to the same places. So I have revealed, you know, more. I mean, I did leave on the map because there's a drawing of the map in the US edition. That's my drawing, and I did leave in my head a few places that I, just in case, I could then label later so that I could reveal there were more places. So, but you need that. You need to sort of, you can't keep on the same, in the same place. You have to keep some of the same places. For example, the Lost and Foundry is really important, but I have to expand it and find something new all the time. But I do think, I mean, I'm quite confident there is material for 5 books, unfortunately. But I do think if I'd been given 7 books, that might have been a bit much. I might have been struggling a bit to find inventing things.
Yeah, like I think we need a sister city or something.
Yeah, we need to get on a boat and go somewhere else now. Yeah.
Have you gotten better in your drafting process that you don't hit 100,000 words now and you get closer to like your word count at this point? Or are you still overwriting and cutting half a novel?
Well, I am coming from the other way now, so I'm sort of building up. I'm not hitting such a high number, but they are pushing. They have grown a bit. So Gargantus was 60,000. words, and the next two are a little bit more than that, but not much more, because I think 60,000 is a good limit for a middle grade book, and over that it's pushing it a bit.
Yes.
And so I'm slightly worried if I go over 60, but I think it's still okay.
You see that, like with most series, that you'll see the book slowly getting larger, than the last book is like double the size of the first one.
yeah, I think that's always, I don't know, that always looks a bit odd to me. But at the same time, if the books get smaller, that looks worse. So if you're going to do it, you have to get a little bit bigger each time, because if it tails off and the last one's a pamphlet, that's not good.
That's true. By the way, I don't know if you knew this, because I don't know how big the company is now, but there's a company that's called Herbert's Lemonade. I know. So as soon as I saw the name of your character, I started laughing. I was like, it was owned by Hansen's, who owns Monster Energy Drink. I think they sold it to Coca-Cola or something. I don't even know if the company's around anymore.
I have to look that up.
Yeah, it's Herbert's Lemonade. It was so funny when I saw it. I was like, Herbie, wait a second.
Because I don't know whether you know, but there are some things in the book that don't really translate. They're not very obvious necessarily in the US. So, for example, the names of my two main characters, there's a reason for those names. They're named after some candy that we have in the UK, some sweets that are really traditional, kind of old-fashioned sweets. Sherbet lemons. I don't know if you've heard of sherbet lemons. No, you can't get them in the US, because I've been told, but they're not so well-known. But in my family, we've always called them Herbert lemons for some reason. That's where the name comes from, as a joke.
That's so funny.
And then I needed to find something that worked in the same way for a girl. And we have these sweets, very strange-looking kind of purple sweets called Palmer Violets. And I went out and bought some, because I thought, that could work. So I went out and bought some. Bought them home. I hadn't had them since I was a child. And I opened them up, and I remember them being really weird, sort of sweet, soapy sort of things. And I just thought, well, this might not work. I ended up eating a whole packet, because they were really nice. Because I did end up having sweets in bowls beside me while I was typing, which isn't very good at my age. But yeah. those sorts of things, the names are sort of based on. So it's interesting that there is this Herbie's lemonade. That's fun.
Well, the only thing I know from England I know a few things, but one thing I know is digestives, but I guess that's not really a name of the character. It's also interesting because I don't remember what the name of the town is that I was in, and it's near London, and it's a seaside town, which totally don't remember what it's called, but it's probably not great. But I do remember it's the only time I've ever seen the tide going out so far, because I'm in California, and in the U.S., the Atlantic, the Pacific, there's no receding tide like that. And that's kind of an important part of Malmö, that the tide goes that far out. The only time I've ever seen it from all the countries I've been in the world, which not all of them, but it's a few. I've seen a few different oceans. I've never seen it like I saw it in England, the tide going out so far. So I actually haven't asked like a kid about it to say like, do you think this is magical? Or do you know that this really happened in places? I remember just standing there and like, where is the ocean? And I see that the ground is wet, and I see there's boats sitting in the sand. And then by the time the tide came in, it happened very quickly.
Yeah, so, it's quite striking. And if you're a bit disorientated, or you go to sleep for a while and you wake up, then you feel as if you've been moved, because the sea is just gone. And then there's stones and sand all the way. It's a big part of the story. And I forget that isn't normal in many places. But it's one of the biggest tidal ranges in the world is on the English Channel, on the French side as well. In fact, in France, I think near Le Mont Saint-Michel is one of the biggest tidal ranges in the world. And it just goes out for miles.
Oh, wow.
And when it comes back in, you can be cut off by it. It comes back in so fast that they say it can overtake a galloping horse. I'm not sure if that's quite true, but
you're like, which horse exactly are you speaking of here? Like a pony that's a little tired. Yeah. Wow. It's almost like England expands and retracts, like the size of the country. With the tide.
There is this land that's kind of no one's, that kind of appears and then disappears again. And it's always different. And you can go and put a flag on a little island and say, that's my island. I've just discovered that, and it'll be gone in 3 hours.
That's so true. It was also, and I may have overread this, but I felt that when I was reading Malamander, it seemed like there were also a lot of sort of nods or winks or references to other kind of like sea books. And that's a very like broad category, but I don't know if, or I don't know if you'd want to say, are there any that like, oh, I slid this in here and I'm not sure if anyone got it, but I hope they got it. You know what I mean? Like, is there anyone like that? They're like, I don't know if anyone's going to get this, but I'm going to put it in here because I get the reference. Do you have anything like that in there?
Yeah, a few more in Gargantis. Actually, I went a bit over the top in the second book, slipping in references. So there's a Star Wars reference in Gargantis, just for the sheer hell of it. And a few people spotted that, and that's been quite fun. And also, Irwin's name. I wasn't sure whether people would guess how I was inspired to call the cat Irwin. And so I put a little scene in Gargantis that people might spot. They might spot it. Some have. And it's quite fun. So I don't want to spoil it if no one's read it, but there is a little scene that should give away why Irwin is called Irwin. But I can't help myself. I keep putting these things in there and chuckling away over my keyboard. Sometimes I have to take them out again. The editor's like, can't do that.
I have one of my books that my editor told me, she's like, I didn't get what you were doing here until like my second read. Most readers are not reading the book a second and third to get what you're getting at. And I was like, well, does that mean I have to take it out? Because I kind of like it. We kept it in, but I don't think anyone gets it. So I'm like, I don't know. I guess as authors, sometimes we just have to amuse ourselves. See, now you said that, I got to go back to Gargantis now. Like, what did he mean with this? Did I catch it the first time? I don't remember. I kind of read it very quickly because I was so excited. I was like, yeah, another one. It's good. I got three more to look forward to now. It's exciting. We always finish with the fill in the blank of, I love it when writers, illustrators, authors, agents, publishers, books, etc. do X, and I really don't like it when they do X. So how would you fill in the blank for those ones?
Well, I love it when books keep me up at night. That's happening less and less now as I get older. So I tend to find, even when the book's really great, I'm just falling asleep. You know, I go to bed to read and then I fall asleep. But sometimes I just can't sleep. I need to know. And I love it when that happens. That's a sign of a really great book, I think. And then I don't like it when books... I think I don't like it when a book is just... I just forget to read it. You know, when you're reading something, but then you suddenly realise you haven't read it for 3 days and it doesn't matter, and you think, well, that's not a good So, you know, I'm always wary of that. It's a shame when that happens, because not everybody is the reader for every book, so it's bound to happen. But, yeah, I always think it's a shame when you read something and it's not quite clicking. I'm not sure if it's fair to say that one.
Yeah, I've met different readers or writers I've spoken to. Sometimes they'll say if a book doesn't catch them, they'll put it down and they'll stop. And something like, no, I forced my way through the book because I got it, the person worked it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I forced myself to read it. But forcing yourself to read it becomes such a chore. No one wants that either. Like, are you doing anyone a favor with that? I don't know. I try to finish every book I start, but there are times it is difficult. And I feel so bad at that point.
Yeah, but I think life's too short. And there are too many books. I think if it's really not working, you have, there's always this massive pile of books to read, you know, and so...
That's true.
I think it's okay.
That's true. Well, actually, now that I still have you here, what kind of books do you usually read? Are you reading a lot of middle grade? Do you mix it up with adult or picture books still?
I try to read more non-middle grade if I can. I think it's important to read quite broadly. So I'm just reading Ben Aronovich's The Rivers of London, which is a sort of magical fantasy. It's a bit like Harry Potter meets police procedural. It's an interesting... set in London, and there's magic, but there's crime, and there are policemen, and it's a bit odd, and I didn't know. I just picked it up at random, and I'm really enjoying it. So I just think it's important. I think if targeted reading, you can end up going down a sort of cul-de-sac. You end up going down a non-through sort of route where you're picking what you read all the time, and you're just reading in one little corner. And I think if you just pick up a book on random and see, you know, you might find something. This is kind of my inspiration for The Mermonkey, was that the kind of just finding a book by random is often more exciting than choosing very carefully what you want to read.
You mentioned the Mermonkey. That is so creepy. The Mermonkey is so creepy. Maybe it's just the illustration of it. Even though I think on Twitter you had posted pictures of like the sea town or something that sort of inspired some of Malamander. And then there was a picture of like a monkey there that kind of did look like the Mermonkey just without the mer-tail. And I was like, what? Yeah,
but it'd be really exciting to see it, you know, see it actually. I'd like someone to make one.
Oh, shout out. Yeah. Who wants to make a fan art? We need fan sculpturing now. It'd be even cooler if we could pick the book for you. I'd be so impressed if they figured that part out.
Yeah.
Very good. Oh, actually, one more question. As part of your range of reading, are you, I would say, required, suggested to also be reading U.S. market versus U.K. market or anything like that? Or they don't necessarily care. Like if you're reading in other, like potential where books could end up for English-speaking markets.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been under any pressure to specifically read any US books, but you know, some come my way, and I'm always intrigued to see what's, because it is different. There's a slight difference in what sells and what's big at the moment, and it is intriguing. I'm always quite and US books. This is a slightly different shape. I just find myself drawn to it. So paperbacks in the UK are a bit narrower.
Oh yeah, that's true. I bought once a paperback outside of the US, and I was like, what? Yeah. It feels
that's
different.
The UK Malamander, the US one is there somewhere, but it's definitely a, you know, half an inch wider. And there's just little things like that are quite intriguing. So I'm always drawn to US books if I can find them.
So they have a cover difference, they have a size and feel difference, they have an everything difference.
It's different. They're really different. It's the same language, except it's all different, you know?
Yeah, we just have to prove that we're still our own country. Maybe that's what it is. Okay, well, very good. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for joining us. It was so much fun to speak with you.
Thank you, Esther. It's been really great. Thanks so much for inviting me. And yeah, good luck with everything. Good luck with your own writing. And yeah, let's stay in touch.
Thank you.
This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast featuring author Thomas Taylor. To find out more about Thomas Taylor and his work, and to visit Erie on the Sea, please check out the link in the episode notes. To keep track of Oh My Word podcast and all the great stuff we're up to, please check us out on Instagram at Oh My Word Podcast or eltenenbaum.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.